Well, I guess let's start, and anybody's going to come. You ready? All right. For a little while, this is going to sound like what it really is, a class on mysticism. It's a class on astrology. To a very large extent, we live in an illusion. And that illusion is a consequence of partial knowledge. And the name of that illusion is materialism. We think that what we see around us is all that there really is. And that it is reality. It certainly is reality, but it isn't all that there is, and that's the part that's dangerous. From quite a few rebirths and spending so much time in this outer three-dimensional world, we have put ourselves into an exiled state of consciousness. We live by the senses, and we're almost completely beings of sensory input. Even to some extent, our intuition is not very strong. What we're trying to get at is the fact that the senses are fine. They deal with states of reality. But there is something more, and it is that something more which is the greater part of the cosmos. This three-dimensional outer world is a very small part of it. Slowly, the understanding of what the material world is like and what it's all about is being wiped out. But the part that is, to me, most dangerous is that people want to cling to this and to believe that everything comes as a result of matter. Even our ideas, imaginations, feelings, all of those things are a product of interactions of matter. Now, if we work at it, and if we decondition ourselves from materialism, we can have experiences. We can have experiences in other realms. And some of those realms are very transcendent. They transcend even reason, and they get into states of being that go beyond what we now consider, you know, we don't even know that such states exist. Now, until this point, when we've looked at astrology, we have looked at basically ideas, and we've seen how those ideas get focused into the dense physical world. But even in that, we have been dealing mostly with phenomenal things. Things like thoughts, distinct emotions, energies, and other things like that. Things that have a beginning and things that have an end. Well, mystics claim that this is even taking into account thought, mystics claim that there are states of being that transcend even concrete thoughts. And it isn't something that's exclusive to a mystic. The whole idea is that anyone who wants to take the time and the trouble to disburden themselves from false beliefs and at the same time develop the kind of sensitivity that one can experience rarer states of being, anyone can prove it for themselves. It's not easy because we have so much belief and so much security in this world that we think everything is going to come to an end if we drop our attention from it. Now, astrology, as we've said all along, is a wonderful, wonderful tool but even for the phenomenal things that we've looked at, it's barely adequate because there is so much that is going on in all the spiritual worlds. Its relationship to transcendent things, especially very deep transcendent things, is such that astrology is even weaker as far as being able to represent things that are very, very profound, things that are truly spiritual. But that's what we're going to do now. We're going to talk about what are called the octave planets. And the octave planets that we will be using are Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. Mystics, East and West, ancient and modern, have always claimed that there are 12 planets just as there are 12 signs. And that the octave planets have that eerie pentatonic relationship of the five sharps in 12-tone music. They're like the black keys on the piano. Or they're like the regular planets are like the seven spectral colors, and the five are supraspectral. We find these things all over. We find seven male Olympians and five female Olympians. And it just goes on and on. You can do fascinating things like that and talk about the five and the seven making 12 altogether. Now, the planets that we see around us and everything that they represent are in the phenomenal realms. I don't know how to say it. I'll give you a picture. It's a rather hackneyed picture. And it's a terrible two-dimensional thing to represent something that's a totally different kind of dimensionality. This, you might say, is the center of being. This represents concrete thought. This represents emotion, desire, feeling, all of those things. This is the physical world. And it's broken into two part, etheric energies. And the chemical stuff. The solids, liquids, and gases. This center of being on the other side of the lens is where the true creativity is. It is the realm of the threefold spirit. This is the region of ideational thought. This is called life spirit. This is called divine spirit. Sometimes the region of ideational thought is called abstract. And it is the home of the self, which is sometimes called the human spirit. We're saying that this physical world, the stuff that we see around us, is interpenetrated by life and energy that is vital. And interpenetrating that is a world that is made up of emotions, feelings, and desires. It is what motivates the energy to have things move and grow, and that is what finalizes things in the dense physical world. The reason behind the motivation is comes from concrete thought. And we as human beings, unlike some of the other creatures around us, have a concrete mind that we can project thought to direct motivation the direct desire to cause energy to be expressed or to take action and to produce a change in the dense physical world. This is something that happens to us all the time. Anytime that we, the spirit who is watching things and has an idea of things, anytime we conceive of doing something, we carry this out. Going the other direction, we have experiences in the physical world, and they are transported inwardly so that we have an emotional impression of what's going on outside of us, and the memory gets carried through as a thought, and the self has a conclusion about that. So if you're doing something as simple as driving down the highway, what happens is you see a car coming from the other direction, you don't know whether you can pass or not. But you take in this information from the external world, and the spirit makes a judgment, and when it has made its judgment, it either passes or it hangs back and does not pass. These are things that we do in, oh boy, I'm getting a bit sneezy again. I'm getting chalk in my nostrils. And these are things that happen thousands, if not millions of times per second if we're really watching something all along. It's like a continuous activity. It's going on all the time. On a much deeper level, the will to be is the divine spirit. And it takes to itself the pure imagination. That is something that will give form any impression of will. And from that, an idea is conceived. The chief idea, the one that resides closest to this center, is the idea of God. Everything above here is spirit, but the idea that is given to be a being is called God. It's also the idea of self, so that anyone who has an experience of self in the transcendent realizes that they are also God, or at least that they are a focus of God, perhaps not with as much manifest ability and power as the singular. So anything then, the whole world around us is created by a focus through the lens of mind into the phenomenal world. These are called phenomenal. These are called transcendental. Oops. I'm a first phonetic speller, which means I don't know how to spell. Sometimes some people call the transcendental worlds, they call them numinal, but those, you can tell those people right away, they're academic philosophical types. You've got them pegged as soon as you hear the word numinal. All right, so what we're talking about here, what we're saying is that the transcendental spiritual states reflect off of the lens, just as we can automatically reflect off of the bottom end of the lens, or they can project things through into the world, and they can draw things back through the lens and mirror of mind. Now, the octave planets are planets that represent things that we see in this world on a higher level in the spiritual worlds. The word octave is the perfect word because in an octave relationship, a tonal quality has the same tonal quality, but it has a different timbre, a different pitch being at a higher or a lower octave. But it's still the same quality that it has. All right, and so what we're going to be talking now about are octave planets. And this talk and the next two will be on octave planets. And when we do that, we have to be careful because we're dealing with a very controversial subject.
And because most astrologers are materialists and do not study mystical things, or think they do but really don't, they're a bunch of anti-realists. They don't understand what we're going to be talking about now. If let's put it almost like a QED, let's put it in the form of a theorem. The first statement of the theorem is that there are universal transcendental states of being, and that those states of being get focused through the lens of mind from the transcendent worlds to the phenomenal worlds. The what gets focused through has the character of the spiritual state that is being focused. But when it gets focused into this phenomenal realm, it takes on a different state of being, but there is still the similar characteristic is carried through from the other side. Moreover, because things go through a lens, they get inverted through the lens of mind. And this is something that happens all the time. We've talked about it before, that we really see the world upside down. And our mind makes the correction. Little babies don't make that correction. Little babies don't know that they're seeing things upside down. But because the eyeball is a lens, when the light comes through it, it gets inverted. And psychologists have done experiments to prove this. They put goggles on the people that invert, so that what you see is an inverted image. And at first people are, you know, they don't know what to do. They're seeing everything upside down. And after a certain amount of time, the consciousness corrects, and they see things right side up again. And then they take the goggles off of them, and then they see everything upside down, which is the way we're seeing it all the time, and until the spiritual consciousness comes through and corrects. But the second correction happens much more quickly because the spiritual consciousness is on, and it's not to be outdone by a few petty psychologists. But you get what I'm trying to say, that there is an inversion. But at the same time, as there is a basic quality from the spiritual world that is inverted and carried through into the material plane, that inversion causes something like a gender change. So that what is positive or masculine in the spiritual becomes feminine and receptive in the material. But at the same time, it's associated with the physical planet. And that physical planet then takes on the characteristics of the inverted polarity. And that inverted polarity, in the illusion of most materialistic astrologers, they think that is truly the nature of the planet, rather than realizing that the true nature of the planet is transcendent. The word octave means nothing to them. So they get it all backwards. They have let's take an example. We're going to be talking about Uranus for most of the evening. The life spirit is a state of being that is called, in Christianity, it's called the realm of Christ consciousness. It is the realm of pure truth. Pure truth that transcends even an idea or a principle, or a universal law that contains the pure truth. It's undissolved. It's just completely, completely pure truth. Now, and that truth is light. It's not like the light that we see out of my goodness, we're bringing more out there. It's not like... I'm the editor for these things. It has a terrible time, I'm sure. It's not like light that we see with our eyes, but it's more like the light when you perceive the truth of something. Inwardly, the lights go on. When you get the idea, you also get the truth that is within the idea. That's called life spirit, and that is associated with Uranus. The quality of the life spirit relative to the willing divine spirit the life spirit is called the spiritual feminine because it takes impressions of will from the divine spirit and manifests them. But they're fairly close to being co-equal. And it's something that had that, you know, theological philosophers for thousands of years have battled. They say, does the divine spirit inform the imagination, or does the spiritual feminine draw out the masculine? And there are always people in both camps. It really doesn't make any difference as long as you have the two functions, will and imagination, working together, and you accomplish things, that's all that really counts. So the feeling of Uranus in its truest spiritual nature is life spirit. And we know that quality, the love, the unified love of life spirit, we know that is altruism. Where you love everyone and you love everyone the same. In fact, if there is any proportionation of love, it is that you give love where it is needed most and not necessarily where it is the most pleasant to give it. Now, when that gets inverted into the physical world, the Uranian love, Uranus, is the higher octave of Venus, so that Venus is personal love, it's individual love, it is somebody that you know, like you like to pet them, they're nice, they're sweet, they're things like that, you socially, not that way, we'll pass on all of that. So the polarity gets reversed and the love is experienced at a lower octave. But the planet Uranus as a physical planet appears masculine. It's a planet that is associated with technology. It's associated especially with electricity and electronics. So that those who don't really know about the inversion say that Uranus can't be the octave of Venus because Venus is the planet of love and Uranus is the planet of technology. The lower side of Uranus is the planet of technology, but the higher side is a spiritual feminine. So when we're dealing with octave planets, we have to say that there are two levels that they are experienced on. One, on the transcendent level, which has the opposite gender that it does on the phenomenal level, and one on the phenomenal. All right. Now let's start looking at them. The higher octave is Uranus, and it is associated with altruistic love. The lower side of Uranus, which is masculine, is associated with technical intuition. But a funny thing of it is, and I've gone around and I've checked with, I worked with a lot of electronics engineers and electronics technicians, and I've even gone around to garages and asked people who had very strong Uranuses in their chart that were mechanics, the Uranian types get the feel of things. They get the feel, and then The logic comes afterward. Everything about Uranus is Platonistic. For the Platonists, they got the intuition in first, and then they added the logic later. The Aristotelians try to go with logic to the intuition, and sometimes it works, and sometimes it doesn't work. The basic quality for both the higher and the lower octaves is love. Venus is a specific love, an objective love or a personal love, whereas the Uranus love is unconditioned and it's unconditional. It loves everything, everyone, all with full intensity. Now the human spirit is reflected into the concrete mind. And so the quality that is common to both Neptune as the human spirit and to the lower octave Mercury is some kind of reasoning. However, the Neptunian reasoning is very different than the Mercurial reasoning. Mercurial reasoning is very linear and it works from all the facts that are presented to it. The Neptunian reason, it has a connection, but it's in a chaotic state. It can connect things that do not follow linearly. So it's a superconscious kind of reasoning. And so the ability to deal with spiritual complexity in that superconscious reasoning is what Neptune is all about. When it gets inverted and there is Neptune in the physical plane, it becomes a feminine planet rather than a masculine creative planet, like a composer of music is like Neptune in the higher sense. And when it becomes feminine, it becomes extremely passive. It becomes like a medium or somebody like that that can't even keep other beings from taking its own body away from it. And rather than, it tries to give the appearance of being something other than it is, rather than having that very different Neptunian quality. So it's associated with camouflage and cosmetics and things of that nature. They're about the same thing. The divine spirit is associated with Pluto. The lower octave of Pluto is Mars. The power is with Pluto. Something happens with Pluto that with the divine spirit that it's almost asexual. Power is power. The lower manifestation of it, when it comes into the physical worlds, it is also in a way asexual, but it's very stubbornly negative and it's obsessive and all of those kinds of qualities. Whereas Mars is the lower octave energy that from power. Power is always works in potential by influence. Energy always is actual. It's put into motion. So that gives you a very rough idea of the relationship of the three higher and lower octaves and the kind of polarity change that happens on the in the passing through the lens of becoming. Now, there are things about the octave planets that are very hard to deal with because they deal with things universal and because they deal with things that we're mostly unconscious of, highly irregular. You don't know what to expect from them. I don't think that there's a person that has studied astrology and has worked with it much at all that has never been bitten by that, because you never know for certain what's going to happen because it's creative. You know, if you take astrology of the past, you know, like they try to do with computers and say, well, all of these people did this, you don't know that the next time that somebody's going to do something creative with that planet, it's going to be all altogether different. And that's the way it works with the octave planets. They're very, very hard to deal with, especially if we happen to have clouded consciousness, and especially if we happen to have clouded ethical and moral consciousness. Because, you know, if you give a powerful device to somebody who is not exactly morally correct, they can do horrendous things with it, like all kinds of black magic and things of that nature. And it's just something you don't want to put into the hands of somebody who is not ready for it. All right, let's look at some general keywords that apply to all of the octaves, Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto. Genius. They all have their particular kind of genius. They all have to do with things that are spiritual. And each in its own way is timeless. Each in its own way is boundless. And if you like that word, each has its own kind of infinity. Each is creative. And because there is no impediment to to the spiritual worlds, the effect of each planet can be immediate. However, it seems abstract. Each of the octaves is divine, and each has its own kind of magic. Each is intuitive. Well, the intuition of Pluto is a very hard thing to understand. And for us, the things that are represented by the octaves are symbolic. And all of them go beyond the physical things. All of them is indefinite, all of them are indefinite and eternal. The effect of the octave planets is subtle. And one must be sensitive, and the octave planets produce sensitivity for that subtlety. And all of the octave planets are uncertain. And to us, because we don't understand all of the sides of the spirit, they're very complex to deal with. They're tricky. And they all have a quality of being hidden. They're unpredictable, and they make very rapid changes. They all have to do, each one of them has to do with a special kind of invisibility. And each of them can be deceptive or illusory. And they all have to do with not your ordinary states of psychology. You know, like both Neptune and Saturn have to do with fears. Saturn is, if you're standing on the railroad tracks and you see the train bearing down on you and you're afraid, that's Saturnine kind of fear. But if the possibility that there is somebody that you can't see that may be your enemy from your past life, and you don't know who they are, but they might strike you at any moment, that's the Neptunian kind of a fear. It's like that. And all of them are very elusive and very preemptive. You just don't want to jump to conclusions about them really quickly. So be very, very careful, and use plenty of observation and plenty of intuition. All right. We are working with Uranus. Obviously, since we have an octave planet, we have to have two personifications. And those personifications, each of them can be all masked together, because in spirit, the unity of things is such that there is no partitioning of consciousness. So let's look at the phenomenal personification of Uranus first, because that's the one that you're most likely to encounter. If you can perceive or conceive of somebody that is irrational, not necessarily focused on spiritual things, but just has a complete irrationality, as if they're doing things by chance, but maybe there's intuition there, that's sort of like what a pure Uranian personification is like. It's a person who does things suddenly, as though they were struck by lightning. And everything that they do has an impact to it. It might seem amazingly true if it's well focused, and it might just seem, this is crazy, if it isn't focused. So it might be someone who speaks with arbitrary truths, but it usually isn't. It's usually a mix. Now, this personification in the phenomenal is very inventive. It's very ingenious, and it's strikingly unique. And even if it isn't unique, it tries to be. It's unique without any studied intention of doing so. It does deal with things that are unexplainably spontaneous. You know, like if somebody who's never ever had a piano lesson in their life sits down and starts playing piano by ear the first time they try playing it, that's an Iranian type of person. No training, no knowledge, but somehow just plays by ear. That is, just listens to the intuition and follows. Focusing on Uranus is one tunes in to the creativity of the individual. Meaning to say that if you have a horoscope and you want to find out whether this is a really creative person or not, you focus on the Uranus. And you stay focused on it until you get an intuitive feel of what the person is like. Now that creativity can be quite varied. It can be mechanical, it can be electronic, it can be chemical, it can be a bohemian artist, or it can be a creative revolutionary, and it can be sort of a social oddball, or a domestic improviser, as I am. You want to eat my dinners. But whatever the case is, the intuition is always felt. And it's always born whole. And you can't necessarily associate it with something else until after the birth is over, and sometimes quite a long time. The Iranian intuition always has the feeling of being a blessing of divine love. It always has a feeling of wonder about it. And it usually is almost always for the sake of others, and not just for the sake of knowing or doing something. So it's a sudden prompting to do something, and it doesn't seem miraculous at all until you think about it, and then it is. So the Iranian consciousness, even in the phenomenal personification, has this divine sense of awe. It happens more to people who live more soulful, serving lives, but it also happens more to people who listen to it and know how to be open to it. Living in an Iranian way is the way to break up hypermentalism. If you're one of those people that everything has to be logical, and you know, you get real tight mentally, appealing to the Iranian intuition is a good way to shatter that, and shatter it quite decisively. If it's put together with different planets, different things happen. Uranus by itself is sudden awakenings. Whether it is Zen and working with a Zen cone, or having to deal with a paradox, both of which break up your mental continuity so that the intuition can come through. You can always spot the highly Iranian people in that they have a lot of breaks in their handwriting, even where breaks are not supposed to be. They leave breaks in between letters and things like that. When Uranus is linked together with Mars, the desire and energy, it just goes zip with everything. However, if it's impeded by Saturn, it becomes tremendously explosive. Uranus is an explosive and violent planet if it is in any way obstructed. And Uranus-Mars people probably experience more pain than anyone else. It's a really painful kind of thing. And it's impatient, so it's likely to explode almost all the time, because things change very, very slowly here on Earth. And Uranus wants heaven on Earth, and it wants it right now. And so it's willing to be revolutionary or anarchical, whatever it takes in order to bring that about. It wants independence. It wants liberation. It wants license. Uranus and Venus, or Uranus and Mars, are free love people. You know, they want that complete license. If it's associated with feminine planets, it indicates intuition and spiritual states striking the emotions in such a way that the emotions can't live up to it. They sort of go into an overdrive. What we're talking about is something like hysteria. Show me somebody with the moon square Uranus and a good strong square, and you've got somebody who is very likely to be hysterical. It does things oddly. And if the polarities get screwed up, it's the planet of homosexuality or otherness behavior. Even in its very best, it's odd and it's singular and it doesn't fit in. With Jupiter, it can be very, very expansive, and it loves to speculate and theorize, and it is the true crackpot. I know that from personal experience. So it's very difficult with this personification to be specific with any of the octaves, but especially Uranus. It's really, you know, it'll always surprise you. If you try to condition it by giving it some kind of brittle limitation, things come apart very quickly. So it is like impersonal lightning bolts of creativity or of blasting. Sometimes, if it's not controlled, it can be something as mild as stuttering, or something of that nature. Whatever it is with Uranus, it will never be boring. Now, if we look at the transcendental personification, which you're very unlikely to see, it's more difficult. At least in the phenomenal, we have some form and we have some logic, and we can understand the weaknesses and the strengths. The life spirit is para-rational or supra-rational. It's beyond anything we can conceive of as an idea. Anyone who has ever had experience of a life spirit says the same thing. It's ineffable. It's ineffable and at the same time ecstatic. It is love without form of any kind. And it is usually because of its loving qualities and its willingness to sacrifice and do anything for the sake of the all. It is referred to as the divine feminine. Obviously, since it's beyond ideas, what we're talking about is something that's beyond almost all astrology. All that astrology can do is indicate how the personality will be shaped, the more phenomenal part of our being, and it can, you know, we can get some ideas about that transcendent, but it's really beyond astrology. It is intelligible light. It is like having an idea and dropping the idea but hanging on to the truth of that idea until that's all there is. In fact, that is an excellent, if you're seeking ecstatic experience, an excellent way to do that is when you have an intuition and that intuition occurs to you and you know it's true, that intuition itself is, you might say, a corpuscle of life spirit. Only life spirit is universal. So if you can dive into that moment, that intuitive moment, you are then diving into the universal realm of life spirit. So it is, it's quite something. It's not like sunlight, it's like the light of truth. It's completely supple. Has no form of any kind. It's formless. That's why it's called pure imagination. From our view of looking at things, because we are so geared and so evolved to be orderly, logical creatures, Uranus always seems paradoxical or always seems irrational. if there is a great manifestation of this, as in the case of Christ or Buddha, they are, you can't understand them when they start manifesting it. The most Iranian person I have ever seen in my life is Amachi, if you're familiar with Amachi. You never know what to expect next from her. She's all love, she's all creativity, she's always happy, and in the next moment you don't know, she's not going to be angry or anything like that, but what comes out next, you have no guess at all. And it's always right, because you can see things without any kind of conditioning. You're not conditioned to think, well, this is the way things are made to change. You don't have that. No. You say, I can create this way. You see it when you work to some extent, even in the phenomenal of Oranis, if an artist is painting and says, this painting needs this color. And you ask them why, they don't know. But they know that it works. They know that it works before they even put it on the canvas. Now, sometimes this can be rationalized. I've been reading a lot of Plotinus for the last few years. And he had waking experiences in life spirit at least 3 times and probably as many as 5 or 7 times in life. And he could talk about it. The kinds of insights that are about things that are way beyond what we normally think about, you can find people who work with them, and they are especially ecstatic poets. Rumi and Kabir especially have that. They're talking about something that you can't even, they're considered crazy. We would lock them up. So what we're talking about here is the personification of a mystic that has wisdom that is beyond any kind of knowledge. And in that pure state, it's completely loving, completely personal, peaceful, and completely harmonious. But the peace that is there is an exciting kind of peace. I don't know how to say it any other way. That when you're really peaceful, it's an exciting state because anything can come out of it. It heals by second nature. If that Iranian, higher Iranian, becomes manifest as the spiritual feminine in the material world and it gets abused, then it does very terrible things. It does things like vampirism and things of that nature. And it likes illogical things and it likes whimsy and things like that. Sometimes it can be swooning romanticism and it can deal with states of existence or ways of living that just evaporate like vapor trails. They're just not there after a while. Obviously, if a person dedicates their life to entering this state and does not use it for healing or redemption or something like that, this is the planet of somebody being blissed out. It's somebody that wants to be in ecstasy and stay in ecstasy and not do anything with that ecstasy to help sluggards like ourselves that are sort of kicking around here in matter. The symbols. Originally the symbol for Uranus was just the H. And the H stood for Herschel, the British astronomer who rediscovered it in the Western world. And it was supposed to be a bold H, and it's supposed to stand for Uranus, but typesetters had a hard time with that, and they couldn't understand it. So they did something to change the symbol, and so they put the... what Uranus lost in mythology, they gave back to him. he was castrated by his son. In Greek, it is Uranos, which equals sky god, or heaven, or the God of high places, as in heaven versus earth. There are not a lot of stories about Uranus, but all of them that there are very peculiar. He was both the son and the husband of Gaia, the earth as opposed to heaven. So there was something incestuous here in that he married his mother. His father is never mentioned, and that's because the divine spirit is almost never mentioned in any mythology, and when it is only alluded to indirectly, and it's always something that you can't speak about. According to the Platonists, the name for the father of Uranus was Phanes Protagonos. So he's associated with high places and high states of consciousness and such like that. Probably because of the ozone. There are two kinds of ozone, just like there are two kinds of cholesterol. There's good cholesterol and there's bad cholesterol. And there's good ozone, and people who practice higher states of spiritual practices claim that ozone is actually a positive thing. At any rate, Uranus was the father of all of the Titans and of all of the Cyclops and of the giants. He produced quite a few monstrosities, but they're monstrosities only from our viewpoint, because they represent creative forces that have abilities that we don't have, like having extra eyes or extra arms or things like that. Those are symbolic representations of trying to say spiritual forces that can manifest more ways than we can with our arms and legs, things like that. He was castrated by his son, Cronus, which means that when things became manifest, then that divine creativity was cut off. Or when we became focused in matter, the way that Saturn is the lord of matter and materialism, we lost the intuition. We lost a lot of that creativity. But he prophesies that his grandson, through Cronus, will eventually rule. The castration also indicates ambiguous sexuality about him. It represents something of the neutral peace and power that we see in castrated animals, like oxen, for example. When everything is all unified and everything comes from altruistic love, then there's no struggle, there's no fighting in that kind of creativity. And it's androgyne. That is, it's suprapolar, it's male-female, and whatever beyond then. But when those kinds of creativity get misunderstood in this physical world, that is where homosexuality enters in. In this world, procreation is important for the continuation of the species. It's not you can create anything at any time, any way, as it is in the more transcendent worlds, and that's how these kinds of things come up. Some say that Venus Aphrodite, the lower octave, was born from the foam in the ocean where the genitals fell into the sea. All right. These are meant to go a little bit faster. And we're getting to be almost done. Planetary figures. People in your life represent one or more planets. And every planet in your life represents one or more people. And that's really, really important. Because through people, you have built your life together with them, and things come out of you in interactions with them, especially in the partnership interaction. You have built what you are not in a psychological void. You have built it together with someone else. And the people who have the most intimate interactions with you have the most to do with the co-development of each other's personality. You see it a lot in places where it isn't quite as socially difficult as in partnerships, but you see it in musicians. A musician will take influence from somebody else and they'll adapt from it, and it goes back and forth that way. All right. One Iranian type of person is somebody who is an inventor or a tinkerer or somebody who repairs things from scratch or just somebody who likes odd miscellaneous stuff. This kind of person is likely to have as a life goal to own a junkyard. I have known several people that it was their ideal to own a junkyard. It's someone who invents things that are unbelievable. These days, a lot of your Iranian people are likely to be electronics designers and engineers. And I work with my share of them, and they're all odd people. And so, sometimes you begin to think that the designing the electronics is what has made them odd. And after a while, you begin to understand that they were odd all along. And I have a lot of Uranus in my horoscope because my sun is opposite Uranus. And I, at one time, made a Rube Goldberg invention. I made a hydrostatic pneumatic nutcracker. What it was is you poured water into this cup. And this cup was on a beam. That's the hydrostatic part. When you poured the water in the cup, the balance beam went down. And at the other end of the balance beam, there was a sharp nail. And it went up. And when it went up, it punctured a hole in the balloon. And the balloon, through a friction string, was holding up this 5-pound lead weight so that when the balloon got broke, wham, it went down and smashed the nut. It wasn't any great nutcracker, but it was...
So you needed a new balloon every time.
Yeah. Oh, you had to do the whole thing new every time, yeah. When I was in high school, we used to make bombs with gunpowder, and we used to make bombs with hydrogen and things like that. These are the kind of people that make odd machines to communicate with the dead and such like that. I one time worked at a place where one of the caretakers was a man who had a strange name. He's long enough dead that I guess I can say his name. His name was Aaron Fried Kolarsi. He was odd. He did own a junkyard, but he gave it up to be a custodian at this spiritual retreat center that I was living at. And there were a lot of old people. And the thing of it is, I never would call Kolarsi, because if you called him in the process of trying to fix something, he'd bust something else. But he had an amazingly nice temperament. And these little old ladies would drop their false teeth down the toilet, and Kolarsi would never complain. He'd take the toilet apart. He was just a sweet man. And then when I worked at physics, when I first started at physics a long time ago, I worked as a film scanner. They did this bubble chamber film. And it was 75-millimeter film. And you had three different angles inside the bubble chamber. And you had a thing. You went up to the next frame. They were calibrated in 10,000ths of a second or something like that. And you looked for certain kinds of patterns. And they paid low wages. It was student hourly wages, and so they didn't mind if you goofed off. And there was this kid named Gale, and he took 75-millimeter film and he twisted it, and he made tubes out of it, transparent tubes. And then we were in these hutches that were maybe 4 feet square, and they were covered with black cloth and things like that. And he made a bunch of these tubes, and he made them just so that a ball bearing would go through them. And he had this thing that he would drop in the ball bearing up here, and you'd watch it, and it would go down a tube, and then it would go down another tube, and it would drop into another tube, and go down it, and go down it, and go like that. And then it would go down, and it would go behind the cloth, and it would pop right into a cup where he was, and he put another one. His goal was he someday wanted to have a junkyard. Oddballs, eccentrics, someone who just happens to love something and it happens to be unconventional. It gets kind of tricky because sometimes it's semi-self-conscious and sometimes it isn't. If a person is egoistic, they play it. But there are just some people that have this odd sense of things. And they develop a disdain for the accepted. This is what happens is when you once get the taste of intuition, the conventional seems dead ever after. And you want to be in that blissed out state where you live completely in intuitions, not realizing that if you tried to do that, you couldn't possibly survive. You can't live in that state, or maybe eventually we'll be able to, but they have if they've had a few intuitions, they have a disdain for the limitations of material reality. And sometimes these are people that can reconcile extremely diverse matters. And no matter what, they're always going to be a misfit. Uranus is the misfit. I have not had such a person in my life, but there is a person in art that is like this. If you've ever seen the movie 1,000 Clowns, the guy that is the lead in 1,000 Clowns, check it out. It's worth seeing. It is really the story of an oddball. Obviously, if there is a mystic in your life, one through whom you feel love and harmony, somebody who is usually strong and silent and just in their presence unifies everything. And that's the difference between the transcendent and the phenomenal. The transcendent always seems completely passive, but in that passivity it accomplishes everything. For some people in this room, that is Amachi. Another kind of planetary figure is the practical joker. One who awakens understandings of things in very irregular ways. Sometimes it backfires and everybody gets wakened a little bit. I have this strange kind of irregular humor that gets very Uranian from time to time. And I can take things, and there are things that everybody sees every day, but if you cause somebody to look at them a different way, they see something different than what is really there. Now, when I was married, my wife was a bit of a contortionist. She really was. She was like triple jointed or something like that. But when she wore pantyhose, they would come up to her breasts. And one time we were visiting my mother and father, and we're standing in the kitchen right next to the entrance into the living room, and she's wearing a little shorty sweater and slacks. And there's a little midriff gap there. And I say to my mother, "You see, that's Karen's operation scar." And what it was the seam of the pantyhose. And I took my finger and I said, see what an operation it was? And I lifted up the sweater and it kept going up. And when it reached the elastic, she knew that she had been taken. But that was it for the rest of the night. We couldn't stop laughing, man. Couldn't stop laughing. But that's the way Uranus, see, creativity does not have to mean making all new things. Creativity means you can see old things in new ways. And creativity doesn't have to be in the Chicago Art Institute. It can be in a pair of misfit pantyhose. The maniac or the hysteric. This is somebody who is directed with fascination often to one thing, and it just gets fixated on that, and that's it. And when Uranus is there, things go unbelievably fast. And almost always, it's an overt kind of activity. Maniacs never keep things quiet to themselves. I have one that comes to the store regularly, and I love her to pieces. But she's certified. She'll blurt out 5 or 6 sentences as if they were one word. And there'll be a mixture of poetry and philosophy and subjective outlooks on life that have no truth to them whatsoever, and just nothing, you know, meaningless stuff. And they'll all get blurted out really fast like that. When she comes in the store, I realize, hey, it's over for the night. I don't have to say another word. Because they'll just take off and brrrr. And I haven't seen her for over a year now. I'll have to ask her psychiatrist where her whereabouts are. I love her to pieces. I just marvel at her. She says things that are poetically beautiful. In fact, she writes poetry, but the poetry that she writes isn't as good as what she just speaks out. It's just amazing thing. And then there are a lot of these that have been in my life. That is the radical or the revolutionary or the anarchist or the libertarian. As long as we get our liberty, it doesn't have to make sense. You know, this is the bomb-throwing equalizer. If we can't do it through altruism, we'll blast everybody to smithereens and we'll all be equal. Everybody is equal at the point of impact. That's a strange kind of consciousness. They like freedom and they like independence, and they don't even want an organized world. It's somebody who's even beyond idealism. And there's one other kind, and that is the bohemian artist, complete with odd theories and unique manners and things like that, and a very romantic way. I'm going to have to just stop on this at some point, but I've had one Uranian bohemian artist in my life that was a rare, rare occasion. And I developed a friendship with him, and he was just, this is a man that spent 40 years of his life learning to play 4 trumpets at the same time. And he was old, he was in his 70s, and he said, he knew he had to have some reason to live. So when I left him, he was shooting for 10 musical instruments. He was trying to put oboe reeds between the mouthpieces. He had developed separate embouchures so that he could have 3 brass mouthpieces, 3 pairs of brass mouthpieces, so that he had 6 brass instruments that he'd play at the same time. And then he was trying to put 3 oboe reeds in between and then play a drum. It would be all homophonic music, but that was his thing. And this is the only man to have fought in 4 different armies in the First World War. He was too young to go into the First World War, so he emigrated to Canada and joined the First World War. And because he was Polish, he eventually fought with the Poles in the First World War. And after the war was over, there was this agreement between Poland and France that he had to come out through France because there was no agreement between the United States and Poland. And so he was in the Polish army, and the French discharged him to the American army, and then he came out. So he was in 4 different armies in the war. And he knew a lot of the Impressionists and post-impressionists in France in his time. And he was one of the only students of the portrait painter John Singer Sargent. Now, Oranis rules what are called accidents. Now, this man's theory was that all of the great discoveries in life came about not through intuitions, but through the combination of intuitions and accidents. And he always used as his starting point, he said, well, volcanism was discovered by accident when somebody threw sulfur into rubber. And he said that's the way all creation happens. And he thought that John Singer Sargent had this same theory, and he thought that the secret of Stradivarius violins was in the varnish. And he said that what must have happened is he must have had varnish on the stove, heating it for painting something, and somebody thought it was soup, and he, by accident, poured salt in. And the salt made the wood more permeable to the varnish. And the claim was that Stradivarii are not, you know, their Amatis are, and Guanaris are just as good as Stradivarii, but Stradivariuses carry in a concert hall better. And he thought that was because the varnish had permeated the wood more. So he thought, if it works for Stradivarius, it'll work for my painting. Now, John Singer Sargent was the last of the school of David, and they were perfectionists, and he fell in love with this noble woman, and he's tried to do her portrait. And the oil paints in those times were such that the more you worked with them, the darker and more murky they got. And he loved this woman's face, and he painted her. Now, this is actual historical fact. He painted her, and when he painted her, he just painted the body real quickly. But that face that he loved, he kept working on and perfecting it. And as a consequence, the face was dark but beautiful, and the breasts were bright. And the French reacted and says, he's the Anglo-Saxon pig. Now, according to Leopold, because one of their noble... And according to Leopold, and this is my friend, he said that this is why the Impressionists and the Abstract Impressionists got going, because it was a reaction against the Anglo-Saxon pig they bought. It's a crazy theory. So, but what happened is that the Americans were affronted by this. And so they hired Sargent, and Sargent was getting $50,000 a whack to do portraits. And my friend Leopold worked for him, because my friend Leopold had been a sign painter, and he goes into all of these stories, like when he was seduced when he was a 12-year-old man, he was living at the end of a hallway where there were no doors, and these women just loved him, and they charmed him into the world of sexuality and all of this. The guy is unbelievable. one of the most unique people I've ever met in my life. But Singer Sargent, not knowing that there were hundreds of generals in the Russian army alone, said, if we win the war, I will paint the portrait of every general on the Allied side. And so what happened is... he hired Leopold. It was like almost like barn painting. Leopold would do these quick outlines of bodies, and then John Singer Sargent would put in the final details. But Leopold had told me why Singer Sargent had to retire early, because he started mixing salt and varnish in his oils, figuring that they would maintain their brightness much, much longer. Well, he did produce very bright, not as bright as they do with wax now, but very bright oils. But after a while, they started to crack because of the varnish and salt in them. And he had to retire to keep from having to spend the rest of his life repairing his earlier works. And so Leopold worked as a set painter in Hollywood, and he worked for Cecil B. DeMille's, and he was a good friend with Mae West, and he's Scorpio, obviously, and he used to do all these lewd innuendos with Mae West, and they would joke around, and Cecil DeMille thought, no, you should, we're going to give you a screen test. And he said, no, I'm not an actor. I can do this for fun with my friends. And they gave him a screen test, and it came out bad, just as he said it would. And Cecil DeMille started laughing at him. And so he threw a bucket of paint on Cecil DeMille, and that was the end of his Hollywood career. And when he had this Hollywood career, he owned three houses in Chavez Ravine, and he was a junk collector. When I met him, he had a storefront that was about twice as wide as this is, and about a third longer of the whole business, and it was filled with junk. He had all these musical instruments. He maybe had 200 hats in there. And he had double slide trombones and slide trumpets, hundreds of musical instruments, but it was all just in chaos, and there were just little paths that went through it. And if you wanted to turn the lights on, he had these long sticks of about 7 or 8 feet that you had to that you had to go and push the light switch to get it to change. He said to me once, he said, I moved in here 5 years ago, but I haven't unpacked yet. But when he was living in Chavez Ravine, learning how to play four trumpets at the same time, he dedicated himself to spiritual philosophy after he got fired by DeMille. But he had this horrible temper, and he blew up, and he was in love with a woman. He was always in love with a woman. He had where he slept in this building. It was like a double bunk bed, but there was junk above, junk below, and like there was a hole that you went in like you were going into a den to get into the bed. And all around that were pictures of beautiful women. He says, I have the artist's eye, and he says, but I can't control my mouth. He says, I see these beautiful women, and before I know it, I have proposed to them. And then the next morning, I have to figure how to wheedle out of it. And so he has all of these pictures of beautiful, beautiful women. He says, but to remind myself, I have them in their natural posture so I know what's up. And then all the women have their mouths. It's just a character like that. But he fell in love with this woman, but she was in love with a man that played a little toy trumpet that would echo off of the opposing mountainside across the valley. And she loved him, and he got snubbed. And then he got angry and blew up, and he spent the rest of his life first learning to play four trumpets because of her. And he was living in Chavez Ravine doing this, and he lived next door to a cabinet maker. And the cabinet maker was from the old country and used to come home and play his zither at night, and he would sing the old songs and such like that until the cabinet maker got his mania. He was going to build the giant zither. and then Leopold will go into a big long history and say it was impossible because you can't tune that many strings because you have to have an iron frame. The piano could not be developed until you could develop the iron works to hold the frame for the piano strings. And he said, this man kept saying, well, it's just Los Angeles weather, or they don't have good wood anymore, or I can't get the right glue, but he could never build a gigantic cistern. And then Leopold says, yeah, these are words that I kept my face, but he said, this is a man that's learning to play four trumpets all at the same time and spending 40 years doing it. He says, I didn't have the heart to tell him he was wasting his time. I have other Leopold stories, but I won't go into them. It gets to be too much. He loved palmistry, and he loved pretty women. I would bring young women up.
Right,
your palmistry. Yeah, you got it right there. when we come to the colors for octave planets, it's very difficult to deal with. Pure crystal, like pure light by itself, is Uranian. Or dazzling whites. And to some extent, anything that is day-glow, or especially things like neon or something like that. Some people claim that electric blues are ruled by Uranus. I don't know if I go along with that. In elements and metals, uranium, radium, and most of the radioactive elements, not all of them. Plants, trees, foods, and herbs, you have to be really careful here because very few are applicable to octaves. Anything that's capable of producing a sudden change. Like there is something that, have you ever read Jethro Close's Herbal? It's an old-fashioned American herbal. And in there he has a remedy, a formula for making antispasmodic tincture. And basically what it does is it uses relaxants, extreme relaxants, and extreme stimulants at the same time. And the philosophy is that the relaxants open your pores up, and then you have a time so that the stimulants come afterwards, and they just they push everything out. It has lobelia seed in, which is potent, and it has a black cohosh and blue cohosh and skunk cabbage, and then it has cayenne pepper. And I made some of it. I was experimenting with that years and years ago. It's for causing relaxation, or especially if you're clogged. It causes relaxation, and then the charge of energy comes behind, and people have been known to hawk out goobers out of their lungs, like never before with that. But there are two ways you can make it. Normally you use grain alcohol, or you use apple cider vinegar. And so I made a big batch of it using apple cider vinegar. This stuff is so potent that pouring a tablespoon of it through somebody's clenched teeth with lockjaw, they have opened their jaws up. And my mother had this terrible flu, and she couldn't get it out of her chest. I said, all you need is one tablespoon. And she took the tablespoon, and she took it down, and she got a look on her face like it was curling her toenails or something like that. It completely blew her away. It did clear everything up, and it cleared everything up that had been lingering for many days. It was very cathartic, and it blew up, but she never, ever used apple cider vinegar again for the rest of her life. I would have used it on myself, but her knee was before mine. Oh, boy. Any kind of food that helps to break down old tissue. Sometimes if you can get the right kind of buttermilk, it will do that. Enzyme-rich food and coenzyme-rich food. I get a lot of it because I take a lot of raw, fresh, organic juice. Endocrine-rich foods, if you are an animal eater. Anything that has a lot of vitality to it. And if you happen to be a breatharian or something like that, prana. Ithuriel is the planetary archangel. Now, the whole question is on what day of the week, because we don't have an Uranus's day of the week. And depending on what you're doing, you can do either a Friday at dawn or a Saturday at dawn. If what you're dealing with is a matter of love and altruism, and that is your issue, you would do it on Friday. And if what you're dealing with is something more technological, or if it is a problem that involved more the rational side of Uranus, you would do it on Saturday, because Saturn shares with Uranus the rulership of Aquarius. Physiology, Uranus rules the pituitary body, which is considered the captain of the endocrine system. It controls all the hormones, and it is partially ruled by the nervous system and partially by the other endocrines. All of the 7 year, it takes Uranus 7 years to go through a sign, and all of the 7 year climaterices are ruled by Uranus. Uranus in the first house, if there is a pituitary condition, often produces giantism. So all of the giants were not produced at the beginning of the creation. It is a receptor in terms of clairvoyance. And it's a clairvoyance that is based on feeling. It rules the optic nerve such that Uranus can join the ascendant. Sometimes people not only have etheric vision, they have astounding observational abilities. I had a friend that was in the first class that I ever offered on astrology, and when I could barely make out the shape of a road sign, and this is when I was young and had good eyesight, I could barely make out the shape of a road sign, and she could read it already. Phenomenal. I've run into several others like that. In fact, I have a series of talks on the ethers and the planets in there. A number of people that have Uranus ruling the optic nerve. All of the etheric flux in the body is ruled by Aquarius, Uranus, and all of the things that are ruled by Aquarius, Uranus has a finger in. In the special categories, it is an octave, which means that it is involved with transcendental things, with spiritual things. It's very dynamic, whether on the lower or the higher octave. On the higher octave, it is the life of life. It may not be going anywhere outside of itself, but within itself, it is alive. It is a generational planet, meaning to say that everybody born within the same 7 year range has the same quality of it. It is the planetary opposite of Neptune. Therefore, if you have Neptunian conditions that are totally afflicted with no relief, you can sometimes apply Uranus to correct them. It's a diurnal planet. It's bright. It's warm. It's dry. It's certainly a superior. It's in its own numerological harmony in relation to, I don't know how to say it. There is what is called Bode's Law or Bode's Law, and that is, there is a harmony in the creative word that comes out from the sun that planets occur at a rhythm. It's an arithmetic formula, such that if this is 4, 4 plus 3, this is where Mercury is, and 4 plus 3 plus 3 is where the Earth is, and the same arithmetic progression goes up all of the interior planets. It starts to break down at between Saturn and Uranus. But between Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, there is a 1-2-3 relationship.
Distance.
Yeah, this is distance. If this is 0.4, and this is 0.7, and this is 1.0, and it goes like that. That's an arithmetic progression, right? And this holds true. It's like saying that, in fact, where the asteroid belt is, there is that fills in one of the empty slots. So maybe there was a war in heaven, as claimed. But when you get out to Uranus, Neptune, and Pluto, you have a 1-2-3 relationship, whereas it takes 7 years for Uranus to go through a sign, it takes 14 for Neptune, and 21 for Pluto, but Pluto's orbit is so erratic that this is only an average. Okay, it is on the material plane, it is masculine. On the spiritual plane, it is feminine. And there is a thing about all the octave planets. Because we don't know how to relate to the spirit yet, many of the things of the spirit, when they come in, disrupt the harmony of things in the phenomenal worlds. And for that reason, all of the octave planets are called malefic. So that if they're in a neutral kind of situation, they are malefics rather than being neutral. Rather than being... basically positive, like Jupiter is basically positive and Saturn is basically negative. And that's it. Oh. Oh, my goodness. Oh, we're not done. I had another page of notes. We have the activation to go into. Venus rules personal love. Uranus rules universal love. Venus rules personal attraction. Uranus rules universal attraction. But there are some things that are opposite. Venus represents attachment. Uranus represents detachment or freedom. Venus likes dependency. Uranus is independent. Venus is patient. Uranus has no patience at all. Except in the spiritual level, then it has infinite patience. Venus is long-suffering. Uranus is sudden. Venus is conventional. Uranus is unconventional. Venus is social. Uranus is either altruistic or unsocial or a misfit. Venus is regular. Uranus is irregular. Venus is smooth. Uranus is jarring. The Uranus rules Aquarius such that wherever Aquarius is where your Uranus will be. Suppose that you have Aquarius in the third house, might be a fascination with liking technological communications. Put Uranus in the seventh house and Aquarius on the third, it might be somebody who likes that shortwave radio business over long distances. Or international relationships or ethnic things would be the subject of communication if Uranus was in the 11th house. So it works both ways. Whatever is in Uranus, and Aquarius affects Uranus, and whatever happens to Uranus affects Aquarius. If the Uranus has its detriment in Leo, And what happens in its detriment is it becomes very intentionally egoistic or egotistic. It has to be different. It has its exaltation in Scorpio, and the exaltation in Scorpio is like free ionization in water, where all of the electrons are detached from their nuclei and they're free to strike wherever they want. And it has its fall in Taurus. Like etching stone with lightning is like what Uranus and Taurus is like. It gets grounded. If Uranus is in the east, it's very wild and freedom-loving. Sometimes they have those wide-eyed stares of a fanatic. Sometimes it produces deformed or irregular features. Almost certainly it's likely to produce a neurotic childhood, very often because the parents are trying some kind of experimental method of child rearing. Sometimes it represents unusual agility, like jugglers have like that. And it likes, Uranus in the East likes nudism. Sometimes it's very tall people tending toward giantism. And very swift, impatient eating habits. I never forget one time I sat down with a man at Uranus Rising. He was very tall like that. And we were going to eat watermelon. And before I had three spoonsful of watermelon eaten, he had two servings eaten. I couldn't believe it. It was yeah, she said, oh, that's my Uranus Rising. Yeah, it really was. Sometimes, if it is a mystical type, it's very soft, smooth hair and those dark, deer-like eyes that look so innocent. Sometimes, like any of the octave planets, it can indicate psychosomatic tendencies. Sometimes it is electric hair that looks like it's standing upright. And Uranus in the East can cause sudden or spasmodic movements. Odd cultural adharmonious environment, like a junkyard. And often it likes bohemian dress. That's it. Next week we will do Neptune. Your friend called already.